in the pleading court. This is a rather lengthy application. I don't have that much experience with mandamuses or procedures, and I don't know how many you get. There are so many issues in them. The issues have been limited somewhat, possibly, by subsequent events or events that have occurred while this matter has been pending. I know that the court is aware that the basic issue, or a basic issue, there's several, but a basic issue is what is the effect on orders of the court, pretrial order, where the case has been passed for some reason or another, doesn't it? If we have a pretrial order in this case, we have pretrial order in this case for a August 10, 1987 trial setting that was passed. What is the effect of the pretrial order after that August 10 trial setting is passed for whatever reason? In this case, we have three such events that occurred. The pretrial order that the court was enforcing for the May 16, 1988 trial was an order for a prior setting, for an August 10 setting. And the mandamus that we sought on May, following the May 24th orders, it's pretty confusing, related to initially our not being able to present expert testimony and do discovery that was commenced prior to the trial at which the court said was governed by the old pretrial order. Things have been somewhat simplified, I hope, by subsequent events, and that is, after the mistrial on May 19, 1988, we went to trial, picked a jury, and then there was a mistrial because two of the jurors, that members of the family, get sick. After that mistrial, which we say is an event similar to that of Ross versus State Department of Public Transportation, which is cited in the brief, the pretrial orders for the two trial settings prior to that no longer were in effect, and that a new, that we were now free to engage in discovery, respond to interrogatories, and do whatever we needed to do to prepare for another trial setting.
Counsel, let me interrupt here.
Sure.
And see if I understand your position. You're saying that as a result of that mistrial, that case had been pending on the docket for 5 years, and the pretrial orders with regards to discovery and the amendment of pleadings and the other dilatory pleas, that was no longer operative, and you could start the process as if nothing had happened? Is that your position?
Yes, Your Honor. Let me explain a distinction, all right? The pretrial orders that we had related to a particular trial setting, it wasn't a general scheduling order.
When was the first pretrial order? Let's have some dates and some trials.
Okay, the first pretrial order, as I recall it, was January 5, 1987.
And did it have a trial date in it?
It had a trial date of August 10, 1987. And all of this is set out in the outline in the front of the exhibit of Relator. Relator's exhibit is the schedule of events and number of the exhibits that
I'm a little bit confused here. I thought there was an order of May 24th saying no more discovery, no more pleadings.
There is.
Well, now you just told us that you've been permitted to do discovery.
I'm confused.
Well.
You have not been permitted to. The orders from August, from the August 10, 1987 trial said were sometimes enforced and sometimes not. The May 24 order following the mistrial on May 19th said no more in the future.
Is that still in effect, that May 24th
order? I argue that it is not.
Because if you're arguing that it's not, what are you doing up here?
Because if you look at our supplemental application for mandamus, I asked the court to enter a new pretrial order, and the court refused to do so. I commenced discovery after the, or recommenced discovery, filed new pleadings after the date that the case had been set for trial, on September 6th. The pretrial orders of May 24, 1988, June 9 and June 13, 1988, were for a set in September 6, 1988. Okay? The court, on its own motion, I believe on August 10, 1988, said that we are going to pass that September 6 trial set because this matter is before the Supreme Court, and I want the Supreme Court to tell me what to do. My argument is that at that point, there were no pretrial orders in effect. And I commenced, or recommenced, discovery. I filed the same thing, essentially, that I had filed before. Designated our experts again, sought depositions, sought discovery. When the defendant did not respond, I filed a motion for sanctions and to compel. When the court refused to set a hearing on those, I asked the court to set a new trial date and new pretrial, and give us a new pretrial order. The court refused to do that, and the supplemental petition for writ of mandamus seeks an order of this court to the respondent to enter an order setting the case for trial, enter a new pretrial order, and giving the trial court directions as to how to handle our motion to compel. So that brings all of my requests for discovery before this court in proper.
Well, let's clear the table here. Whether you have attempted to or initiated discovery since May 24, have you in effect been permitted discovery?
No.
All right, let's back away up. There were pretrial orders July 6, 84, September 14, 84, February 18, 85, May 3, 85, June 27, 85, April 18, 86.
That's correct.
Those all set a trial setting, which for one reason or another was not reached.
That's correct.
Then there was one for January 5, 1987.
That's correct.
Which again set cutoff dates for this August 10th trial.
Right.
And then what happened to it?
Okay, that was passed.
Yeah, it just didn't get reached, or there was a motion for continuance.
Well, what happened was the deposition of my expert, Dr. Bob Gant, we didn't get together on it in a timely fashion. We did not manage that deposition so as to prevent the defendant to prepare for trial. I believe that's what happened.
Do you intend to designate any additional expert witnesses that were not designated as of May 19th? Or have you attempted to designate any additional experts that were not designated as of May 19th?
There have been things that have happened to this plaintiff since May 19th. On August 10th is the magic day for us.
Has he gone to a new doctor and you want that new doctor listed?
He was declared incompetent and sent to the state. He was sent to the VA hospital.
And do you want to call that doctor
as
a witness?
Yes, sir.
And has that happened since May 24th?
Yes, sir.
All right, let's assume the judge, when you get to trial, does not allow you to call that doctor as a witness because that doctor wasn't designated prior to May 19th, when you went to the last trial setting. Wouldn't you have a right to appeal on that?
Certainly you have a right to appeal, but what good is the right to appeal? If we were not allowed to present the evidence to the jury will not know about it, and whatever judgment we get will be per se unfair.
Not necessarily, unless you call the doctor and prove up his testimony on a bill of exceptions.
Well, that will preserve our right to appeal, but that doesn't give us a fair trial. That just gives us a right to another trial.
Is that the function of mandamus?
That has been held to be the function of mandamus in several cases, yes. This court in Jan Paul v. Cushy allowed discovery even though there was a right to appeal.
We're talking about two different things here. You're absolutely correct about Jampol versus Touche. But here I'm talking about the designating of expert witnesses, which is not making discovery, but something entirely different.
Well, there is a distinction, and that is that in Touche, the plaintiff, the party seeking discovery could not make a thorough exception if he didn't have the evidence to bring before court. But that distinction has not been recognized by several other courts. I will cite to you the case of Williams versus Pryor out of Dallas Court of Appeals, in which the defendant, if I'm not mistaken, sought to designate three expert witnesses. I think it was something like 31 days before the trial.
Yeah, that was under Rule 215-5, which says that, which relating back to 166B says, that 30 days is not the absolute minimum. It's whenever you know, but not less than 30 days. That's the way Williams versus Pryor turned, and that's the same thing as in the Onion case out of the San Antonio court.
I understand that. Yeah. The question was whether there's an actual remedy on appeal. But I understand the issue. And there are several other cases that I know that this court has dealt with that issue before and held that, I believe this court has held, that the mere fact that there is a remedy on appeal does not make an adequate remedy on appeal. The Court of Appeals in Amarillo in Home Savings Association versus Beavers, which I don't believe I cited in my brief, 745 Southwest 2nd 504, held that the mere fact that if one can make a bill of exception and bring the matter before the court on appeal does not make the remedy adequate. The question is whether or not you're going to, as I see it, is whether or not you can present your case fully and fairly in the trial. And if you cannot, then you're not granted a fair trial. And while you may have a remedy on appeal, you don't have an adequate remedy on appeal. I would also point out to the court that there are other issues beside whether or not we can present our expert, which come under the Touche doctrine. And that is that 2 weeks before trial, the defendant supplemented a two-year-old deposition, a three-year-old deposition, to inform us for the first time that they were changing their theory of defense and that they had done some investigations of the machine involved in the accident, and didn't tell us when they had done those investigations or those inspections, but told us that they found that the facts that they had reported to us in their deposition were not in fact the fact. And if I may, I'll explain what happened. We're dealing here with an aerial lift truck, which is a platform on the end of the boom, which goes up about 40 feet in the air.
Okay, this is 2 weeks before the May 19th trial?
2 weeks before the May 19th trial, we get a letter from the defendant saying that they are supplementing or they are correcting information given in the deposition of their expert.
All right, one other question. There was free discovery between August 10th, 87 and May 19th, 88.
Yes, sir.
And lots of it.
Like I said, lots of it was discovered.
Okay. All right, go ahead.
What happened was the machine was modified in several ways. One of the things that keeps electricity from getting from the platform, or what was originally plastic buckets, to ground are insulated hoses, plastic hoses, and non-conductive fluid in those hoses, hydraulic fluid. The hoses are orange. The non-conductive hoses are orange. The kind that you have in tractors are wire braided and they're black. And the hoses at the top of the arm were black, had been changed out to black hoses. The expert testified that that change out resulted in electricity being able to get to ground. After the deposition, they went back and they inspected the machine and they found that inside the boom, where you couldn't see it, there was an orange hose breaking the connection to ground, so that you could not get electricity to ground. We didn't know that. And we thought that the whole reason that this man, these people got electrocuted and fell was because the wire braided hose was always the ground. 2 weeks before trial, we were told for the first time that that was not the case. We felt as if we were entitled to get more information about that. We wanted to find out when that was done, when the inspection was done, what proof they had of it, and various other things which are set out in our discovery request. We were denied the opportunity to do that, and the discovery that we saw after the mistrial, in part related to that, and that is something for which we cannot have a bill of exception because we have no proof to go forward on. Therefore, the Jampol versus Touche criteria are met. Now, that's the reason I bring this up. So we have two sets of discovery issues involved. One of them does clearly come under Touche, and the other, we argue, comes under the Home Savings Association versus Beavers situation. Now, there are other things as well. Our pleadings, and this is a somewhat separate issue, our pleadings, after we got into it, we felt that we had not pled for enough money, to be honest with you. From the beginning, I didn't understand or appreciate how badly this person was hurt.
Have there been special exceptions to your damages plea?
I don't believe so.
Then why would you need to plead for any amount of money?
Because I did plead for an amount of money. That was our problem. We pled for an amount of money, and with an inadequate amount of money, I wanted to increase the amount of money.
So you created your own problem here, haven't you?
I created my own problem. The question is whether the law is going to say how we're crushing the trap, or whether the law is going to be reasonable and allow us to do something that isn't going to cause any inconvenience or prejudice to the defendant. I mean, are we back in the days of the old rules where the form is going to eat up the purpose of it?
That rule amendment was adopted for the benefit of plaintiffs so that they couldn't be ragged around court with people waiting the ridiculous amount of damages that they've sued for. Now all you got to do is say in excess of the statutory amendment.
Let me say this, Your Honor. I don't remember whether or not there was an exception to one of the first two requiring us to do this amount. We're now on the Sixth Amendment petition. But that is only one of the parts of the freedom. The other two parts that are before this court is, A, whether we can plead now to take into account the new defense, which the defendants raised 2 weeks before the May 19th trial setting, or the May 16th trial setting. That is, that the reason that the electricity got the ground was not the water braided hose, but that the boom was dirty. Because a dirty boom can cause electricity to beat the insulating quality of the plastic boom, number one. And number two, since this case was filed, and since the August 10th, 1987 trial setting, some new things that occurred. The important one being that the plaintiff had been declared incompetent.
When did that happen? August 10th of this year?
Of last year.
August 10th of 87.
After the August 10th of 87 trial.
But there was no pretrial order.
After that.
I mean, you were free to conduct any discovery between August 10th, 87 and May 19th, 88.
But what I'm talking about now, please, if I may. After that date, and before the trial setting of May 16th, the plaintiff was declared incompetent by the county court at law, and a guardian appointed. We attempted to include the cost of the guardianship as a damage.
We attempted that on May 24th, or May 23rd.
Immediately prior to the May 16th trial.
Immediately prior.
And since then, we've tried it on several occasions. To include that as a damage, as well as the need for a guardianship as a special damage, as a general damage, as part of pain and suffering. The trial court said that we could not have such a pleading. I believe that is contained in the June 13th, either the June 9th or the June 13th supplementary pretrial order.
Did you ever try that on trial amendment or merely on a pleading?
This is not we attempted it initially as a trial amendment, I believe, and then subsequently as a pleading. as a regular plea. Now, that is a separate subject. I mean, that I believe comes under the Lunsford versus Morris rule, and I think we need to discuss that separately, whether or not we are entitled to plead for that, for those items as either special damages, or whether we're entitled to an proof of them as a general damage.
Well, let me ask a more global question. I mean, let's assume for a minute that the court believes that this trial judge, under these particular facts, abused his discretion. What kind of general rule would you have us set up? Because this is our first opportunity in quite some time to write about pretrial orders and their general effect. I mean, if the court had been able to pick a jury the week of May 23rd or May 30th, would you have any right to further discovery? Is it the fact that it was delayed till September?
We would not have had time. We would not have had a right under the rules to any further discovery. No time.
Is there something magic about 30 days, or what kind of general position would you have us? What kind of general instruction should we give to the trial court at this stage about what happens when a case doesn't get reached, or when, as in this case, a mistrial is necessary?
First of all, I'm not sure that I have to deal with what. I'm not sure that my case presents that problem.
Well, you may not, but whatever we write here is going to.
I think.
To have to answer some questions.
First of all, the rules provide for the answer to the question that you asked, whether or not, if the case is set less than 30 days.
I mean, the rules don't, really, because the rules say you can enter a Rule 166 order, which Judge Fry did on May 24th.
And
your contention is that order is an abuse of discretion.
Well, my argument is that is not a Rule 166 order. Rule 166 does not grant the court powers that I think he exercised. Now, there is a Rule 166B, 3, I believe, deals with when the court can limit discovery, either because it's burdensome, unduly burdensome, or unreasonably expensive, or is for harassment, or invade either constitutional or property rights. I'm not sure exactly the language, but I'm not far off. The court has powers under that section of 166D to enter orders which protect a party from unduly burdensome or expensive discovery, which I think comes close to the prior situation. If the court in prior has determined based on evidence that the discovery sought was unduly burdensome or expensive or invaded property or constitutional right, then the court could have entered an order limiting future discovery. But I don't think that discovery can be limited just because for no reason other than the court thinks that it's nice to have a nice, clean, neat cutoff date. My opinion. If I may, I know that my warning is on. I am now 45 years old and practicing this system for 20 years. And I've seen great changes in the way we practitioners have to practice. Things are getting frightening. Cases, we are not perfect. We are not able to do everything perfectly and get cases ready for trial, and we don't understand cases the first day they come in. Before, this case is a very complicated case. It's a very significant case. And it's changed as we have been working on it. It didn't come full-blown and ready to try the first day. I didn't understand, and many other people in my position don't understand when the case first comes before them, the full significance of what they're seeing, how badly hurt their client may be, what the cause of action may be. Maybe just lots of things happen during the progress of the case that bring a new understanding.
Counsel, you've got 5 years from the date of the accident. You know how much time. You know, you want an open-ended opportunity to try a case whenever you think is ripe, and no more changes will occur?
No, but if during the process changes do occur, I think we should have the right to respond to them if there's time to respond. That's the question. If there's a trial setting that's 2 months away and there isn't time to do the discovery, I'm not saying that the rules provide for it.
You're saying in five years he did not have a chance to properly work up the case and get in shape for trial?
I'm saying that things occurred during that process which could not have been anticipated. For instance, on August 10th, men were committed to the hospital. He attempted suicide and allegedly shot a gun at his family. Okay? Those are things that we ought to be able to bring in and prove up. Irrespective of what prior order there may have been limiting the expert.
Well, let's talk about that. I mean, what date was this alleged shooting?
Or alleged August 10th, I believe.
Of 87?
Of 88. Okay, after
was he committed August 10th, 87 or August 10th, 88?
88. Okay.
But it was certified prior to May 16th?
No, he certified that in August of this
year. Maybe I misunderstood something you'd said earlier. Something that you had, for purposes of pleadings, you're talking about pleadings aspect.
I'm sorry. Yes. Okay. He was certified as incompetent.
When?
Between August 10th of 87 and May 16th of 88.
But he wasn't committed until August 10th of 88.
That's right. He was found to be dangerous to himself and others and sent off to an institution. Also, there were new experts that came in. His old psychiatrist moved to Durham, North Carolina, went to work for the university there. He was referred to a new psychiatrist. His treating physician from February 28th, 1988 until the present is someone who we cannot designate. Now that's something we couldn't have anticipated, couldn't have done anything to get ready for.
You could have designated him between February 28th and May.
We could
April 16th.
We could have, but there is no motion and there's no complaint that she was not timely designated. The complaint is that it was not timely designated pursuant to pretrial order requiring that the expert be designated by April 1, 1987. There's not a...
We can't anticipate what the trial judge does. 215.5 says, for good cause shown, the trial judge may allow the late designation of experts. And he may consider that to be good cause, the fact that this other expert came on the scene later. I mean, how are we to assume the trial judge is going to rule on that?
Well, first of all, the trial judge did rule on it.
Oh, he did? He's already refused to allow you to call the new psychiatrist as an expert?
Yes. He refused on at least three occasions prior to the May 19th trial, May 16th trial finish. He refused to allow and struck the designation which occurred after that time.
After what time?
The mistrial. Immediately and timely, before there was any new pretrial order, supplemented our answers to interrogatories to designate this expert. On May 24th, or May 25th, after we had done that, that designation was struck. And then you got the May 24th, the June 9th, and the June 13th pretrial order read together, which does not allow us to, and retroactively does not allow us to, designate these experts or engage in discovery. So what happened is we had a mistrial on May 19th. We have discovery which was commenced when there was no pretrial order, and then we had a retroactive striking of that discovery, those pleadings, on May 24th and June 9th and June 13th.
You would have us say, as a matter of law, that no pretrial order can survive a trial setting?
I would have you say that, yes.
No pretrial order can survive a mistrial. And you start the process all over, is what you're asking us to do.
You'd settle for that, wouldn't you?
Yes, that takes care of it. I would argue that there's no distinction between a case being passed for a particular trial setting and a mistrial. I would settle for that.
Okay, thank you, Ken.
If I can, I make one more comment.
You have rebuttal.
Well, you'll have 15 more minutes. We're now ready to hear argument from respondent. Respondent.
May it please the court, Mr. Rittenall and Mr. Gary Ellison will present argument for respondent. Mr. Nall,
Yes, please, the court. Comparatively, it seems like I'm ready to get up here and start an argument, and I've heard something that the petitioner presented that I've discussed correctly before I get into the argument, and I do in this instance also, and that relates to the pretrial orders that were entered prior to January the 5th, as the Justice Phillips said.
Would you always give a date, a year? Whenever you give a month and a day, would you give the year?
You did have list the correct pretrial orders that were entered by the court, and those were July 6, 1984, September 14, 1988.
How about the year, Counsel?
The year?
Okay.
I thought I said year. September 14, 1988, February 18, 1985, May 3, 1985, June 27, 1985, April 18, 1986, and finally, January 5th, 1987. And the point I want to make, and I want to get this clear before I begin my argument, and that is the fact that after the January 5th, 1987 pretrial order, discovery was not free in this case. It was, at that point in time, the judge had more or less said, no more discovery. We've got a list of expert witnesses this long, no more discovery. The court had permitted the defendants at that point in time certain limited to the discovery. And the reason he did that is because the plaintiff had belatedly designated two additional experts to testify as to this plaintiff's mental condition. And the court said, well, plaintiff, if I'm going to allow you the designation of these two experts, I'm going to let the defendants take you against that position. And so that was the reason, that was the only limited discovery that was allowed after the January 5th, 1987 pretrial. That in mind, I'd like to explain.
Well, now, what happened after August 10th?
After August 10th, that pretrial order continued in effect, and the parties considered that pretrial order in effect.
And so you disagree that there was further discovery between August of 1987 and May of 1988?
If there was any further discovery done, it was done with legal court. And with the history of this case, I can't specifically recall if there was any, but I can assure the court that it was done with legal court. Discovery certainly wasn't free.
Could all this have been avoided if the trial court had gone to trial and avoided state court?
I'm sorry?
Could all this have been avoided had the trial court gone to trial on the date and state court instead of kept putting it off?
Which date?
Well, any of them for that matter. Well,
it possibly could have been avoided, but the court was very lenient with the plaintiff and wanted to give him an opportunity to try his case. And quite frankly, at least on two occasions, the case was continued because the plaintiff came in and asked the court for additional experts. The court said, okay, we're going to have to continue this thing.
Well, just because of the changing medical condition of the plaintiff, I suppose?
That's correct. Yeah. Let me explain this. For 5 years, this plaintiff was treated by a neurosurgeon in Sherman, Texas, as well as other treating physicians. We had taken all the additions. The case was ready to go to trial. At the last minute, the plaintiff comes in and says, my client has a mental condition as a result of this. This is the first time after 5 years that this has been alleged. The plaintiff says, I want the court to allow me to appoint two additional experts that I hired, a neurologist and a neuropsychologist, to testify as to my client's mental condition. The court said, fine, but I'm not opening this case up again. There's been too many delays and too many experts designated in this case already, but I'm going to allow you these two experts to testify as to my client's mental condition. And the court allowed him to do that, and I think he was being very considerate toward the plaintiff. But the situation develops is that the plaintiff keeps seeing more doctors, and the plaintiff comes into court again and says, I need another expert because this additional expert is the only expert.
Can you give dates on all of this? Information? Okay, yeah, in between which aborted trial?
Well, I can tell the court on August 10th, 1987 trial setting, it was continued because the defendants had not had an opportunity as of yet to depose the two additional experts that the court wanted to allow the plaintiff to be. If that helps the court get things in chronological order and comes up. And after the August 10th trial setting was passed, there were no additional experts that were designated, no attempt to be designated by the defendants. Of course, the plaintiff is on the evening of trial trying to designate an additional expert. And as I mentioned, the plaintiff...
Can you say the eve of trial? How close?
Well, I think it was 30 days before trial. But of course, in violation of the court's standing pretrial order, it was January 5th, 1987. Speak up a little bit.
Mr. Noll, I'm not suggesting that these are the facts in this case, but let us assume that after the mistrial on May 19th, something entirely new had developed in plaintiff's condition requiring treatment by another doctor. Don't you think that ought to be grounds for allowing an amendment and designation of experts and a reopening of discovery?
If it's reasonable, I think that's reasonable, and I think that's what the court did in this case. It's a matter of degree, I suppose. Are you going to allow the plaintiff 10 experts to prove a point, to 2 experts to prove? It's not necessary. The mental condition, so-called emotional problems that the plaintiff was suffering, the court allowed him to designate a neurologist and a neuropsychologist to testify this condition. And any additional experts that he has are really punitive. But the claimant keeps coming in and saying, I need this new doctor because he's the only one that can testify to his current condition.
What was this about? What I'm having moved, I forgot what he represented to the court.
That was...
that have anything to do with this?
Not really, because I don't think that particular doctor really treated this patient for any sort of a length of time. I think he may have just reviewed his records. I think the claimant may or may not agree. I don't think that's a substantial complaint.
How many experts have been named in this case?
By the trial court's count, 31.
For both sides?
For the plaintiff.
Experts?
By my count, 25 for the plaintiff.
Are these medical experts?
I counted those before the trial, and I counted 15 medical experts. And the plaintiff has a skull fracture right here.
Where?
Skull fracture right in this area. It's overkill, the grossest case of overkill I've ever seen. And the court had to come to the conclusion that he had to get this case under control, and that's what he did. There was, I think the court obviously picked up that the case is 5 years old and that the plaintiff had an adequate opportunity to develop this case, and the court's been very lenient with the plaintiff. He's allowed him every opportunity to designate experts that are going to prove substantial points in his case, like the mental or emotional condition of the plaintiff. Because there's got to be a point in time when you've got to end this thing.
Have ever one of these trial settings been passed on a motion for continuance by one side or the other? Essentially?
Probably so. The case goes back to 1984, and I think we cannot recall the reasons the case was passed back in that period of time. More recently, I'd say 1986, 1987, the case was passed because the plaintiff kept coming in and designating new experts, and the court allowed him to do it. Of course, we had an opportunity to depose, and that discovery process that was continuing during the last 2 years caused the trial to be delayed.
Well, do you think a trial judge can indefinitely shut down discovery? I mean, essentially what you're saying is that every new witness since January 5th, 1987, trial court has a right to pass on it in the trial court's discretion, whether to allow discovery or not. The trial court can allow it all from one side and none from the other side, and that's fair, because the trial judge has gotten control of the case.
I think that's exactly right, because otherwise the only other alternative is that the parties are going to have to decide who gets the designated and who doesn't get the designated. The only logical way then is to allow the trial court to have control with discovery, limitations on experts, because the parties are not going to be able, it's going to be chaos. The parties have to agree upon that. The trial judge, let me say this, if there's a standing pretrial order and there's a case that's passed or mistried or continued, for whatever reason the case is not tried, I think it's incumbent upon the parties themselves. There's additional discovery that needs to be done to go into court and tell the court to file a motion for leave and say, Jack, I need an additional expert, I need to take a deposition, I need to set a request for admission or whatever. I don't think that's incumbent upon the trial court, simply because the trial court doesn't have time to do that. There's no logical reason why the trial court, every time a case is mistried, is passed or continues, why the trial court should automatically enter a new pretrial order, or why parties should petition the court for a new pretrial order.
This court did every time after it said, I guess on the court's own motion. until that August 87th day.
Exactly. I think this particular court in Grayson County, as a matter of course, when the case was passed, it issued an increase in our order. Finally, the judge got put up and said, no more. We've got to get this case under control. And that's why you'll see that the January 5th pretrial order is a letter that's personally dictated by the judge. It wasn't a form of pretrial order. It's not exactly yet what we've got to control of this case. I think particularly that there's much to the argument by the plaintiff, but I really want to take this to G particularly that the trial court does not have authority in a pretrial order. So that's basically what the argument the plaintiff has made, the petition has made in this case, that the court doesn't have authority to control this discovery, to limit the number of experts. He thinks that the court just simply does not have authority to do that.
Well, I don't think there's any question of what you're right on that. The court has authority to render a pretrial order, but it can't abuse its discretion in doing it, can it? I mean, it couldn't render a pretrial order today, set the case 2 years from the day that say as of today, no more discovery. That would be an abuse of discretion, wouldn't it?
The
lay
court did set forth that argument.
How many experts, medical and non-medical, have you designated?
I have not designated any experts. That's the reason I haven't, because I'm going to say it's not experts.
I'm not saying that I have any experts.
You smile, told us that.
I think the plaintiffs are aware of that too.
Any further questions?
I will continue to say questions.
Well, is your co-counsel going to argue, or are you?
5 minutes.
Oh.
The, as I mentioned, I think it's pretty clear to me, as well as counsel for the other defendant, and I think as well as plaintiffs have had changing with that pretrial order did continue in effect. We operated under that order until the time of trial.
You say the record shows that, that both sides came in and asked for relief after August and before May. After August 8th and before May 8th.
Understanding that my discovery file in this case is this thick, I can assure the court that after the January pretrial order, there were probably motions to leave to conduct discovery filed by another party.
But after, I don't care about after January, after August.
Even after August 10th, 1987. Otherwise, I don't think the plaintiff would have filed a motion to leave to designate this last expert prior to the time of trial.
Would it have a sanitary effect on getting cases to trial? If we were to rule that a pretrial order expires with the trial setting?
I think it's impossible to do case to trial if that happens. Because you're going to find attorneys coming in finding reasons to mistry cases, finding reasons to pass cases, finding reasons to continue cases.
They've got additional discovery.
We're getting more, and I'll tell you why I'm asking the question. We're getting more and more complaints
about the rising cost of pretrial procedures to litigants and all of the complications and the effort that goes into it from trial lawyers. The process leading up is a war. The trial is an anticlimax.
The deposition war.
And
how can we
eliminate some of this brush so that the trees can stand up and be safe?
Well, I think this case exemplifies that situation because it's turned into an expert war.
But what do you think we ought to do?
I think the court ought to have absolute authority to cut off and limit the number of expert witnesses. This court had abused its discretion. He's allowed.
Well, I mean, we all agree that this court apparently did not take seriously the instructions of our administrative lawyer, February 10th, 87, the continuances shall be very strictly granted.
trial deadline shall be firm, or something like that. But having got, having the question is now, in this latest instance, has the trial judge abused his discretion
very
narrowly in making this case go
too long before it gets to trial,
and forcing the evidence to become stale?
To answer your question, I think basically what it boils down to is whether or not under Rule 162 or under Rule 168 relating to interrogatories, which is going to control? Is it going to be 166 ordered by the
court,
or is it going to be your 30-day periods under the
Well, 166 order always trumps, as Judge Kilgarwin said, using this particular order an abuse of discretion.
I was referring to this question.
How?
Can be done by the court to clear up the problem to perhaps the pretrial discovery abuse. And I think that the trial court can get control of the case on Rule 166. Then that is going to do a lot to clear up the situation. Because otherwise, the only rules, the only limitations that you have are the other rules, which basically have your 30-day time periods. With a 30-day time period, you're having people come in to court 30 days before trial. So I've got 16 experts I want to do it, and additional facts I want to supplement. And that just continually grows. It's like a running stone that just keeps getting bigger.
What do you do in cases
where, as is alleged here, I know nothing about the actual facts or what's been alleged, where the plaintiff has developed a mental condition
he didn't have before,
psychiatric condition he didn't have before. It changes things, which causes him to want new experts and new evaluations, and he's declared NCM or committed or something.
What
conditions like that do change? You need to leave some flexibility with the trial court, do you not?
I agree. In a situation like that, yes, I think it's dependent on the party to file a motion for leave the claim to the court. I've got this situation as developed, and I think it justifies reopening the...
Is that what happened here?
And that's exactly what happened, yes.
But
I think if he's got a little bit, he wants more. He wants to designate five more experts. Like I said, overkill.
I think if we send this case back and reopen it, that all your experts will have to be deposed.
Oh, sir. Yes. My experts will have to be deposed. His one expert he tried to designate before the May 19th trial was the last he deposed. He's since then probably got four or five he's trying to supplement his interrogatory answer simply to designate more experts. I'll probably have a bundle of experts. We may have an independent medical examination. He's filed since the mistrial of May 19, 1998.
That was not the articulated purpose of the pretrial. The trial court made it very clear in his letter dated May 24th, which is part of the record before this court, and his statements from the bench on May 25th, which are also incorporated on page 59, I believe, 53 of the objections to the court's pretrial order. The court told all the parties the reason he was entering his pretrial order, and it was not simply to maintain the status quo. The court specifically stated that the reason he was doing so was because that, on several prior occasions, he had allowed the plaintiff to reopen discovery so he could designate additional witnesses. And the court was concerned that this case had been set for trial on multiple occasions, which is obvious from the numerous pretrial orders. And the court made it clear that one of his concerns was that if he reopened discovery in this case, that we're going to try this case all over again. We're going to start from day one again. And the court pointed out that since the mistrial was granted only a couple of days earlier, plaintiff already filed five discovery documents with the court. So this certainly confirmed the trial court's suspicion that the plaintiff was intent on reopening this case and intending to proceed with a full-blown discovery wave again. And furthermore, the court was concerned with the cost and deposing all these additional experts and the expense that was involved in that. So it wasn't simply to maintain the status quo. The court obviously saw much deeper than that and realized that this case could conceivably take two or three more years to get to trial if he reopened discovery in this case. I think that's probably typical of how this case is proceeding. Once the mistrial was granted, 25 documents were filed relating to discovery. It's just a never-ending battle. And the court finally realized that he had to get control of it. I think that the issues in this case really boil down to two things. I realize that the relator has filed or brought before this court 11 different complaints. But I think it really boils down to two issues. One issue is whether or not the court's pretrial order of January the 5th, 1987, which set the case for trial on August 10th, 1987, whether or not that pretrial order remained effective beyond that date. Plaintiff, the relator, apparently urges the court to believe, or wants the court to believe that that does not remain ineffective. That every time the case is passed, every time the case is continue, the pretrial order no longer becomes effective. The second issue that I think is before the court is whether or not the trial court abused its discretion in refusing to reopen discovery after the declaration of the mistrial. Practically speaking, I don't think it was even necessary for the trial court to enter the pretrial orders that were entered subsequent to the mistrial. And the reason I say that is because the January 5th pretrial order is still in effect. It continued through August the 10th, through May 19th, and to this day as far as I'm concerned. But apparently the court saw that the plaintiff was intent on reopening the discovery and felt it necessary to enter a couple of more orders to make sure that the plaintiff understood that he was not going to allow further discovery. I think I've probably covered the fact that I think that Rule 166 clearly provides the court's authority and power to enter pretrial orders to the effect and similar to which were entered in this case. But I don't want to belabor that point. If that's not the case and the trial court does not have that authority, then I've been sitting in a judicial system back about 50 years. And I don't think that that's a strong argument, and I don't think that the plaintiff seriously intends that the trial court does not have that authority. I think the plaintiff is instead relying heavily upon the case of State Department of Highways and Public Transportation versus Ross. And this was a Title Court of Appeals case about a year ago, I believe. There's not much law on this particular subject. And quite frankly, I have to say that I disagree with the Court of Appeals opinion in that case. That case holds that if a mistrial is granted in a case, then any previous pretrial order entered by that court becomes obliterated, and that's the term used by the Court of Appeals. That case's application to this present case, I think, is questionable because in that case, there was not a new pretrial order granted after the mistrial. In this case, there was. But regardless of its applicability, I just really don't think that that's good law. I think it's erroneous because from my reading of that case, it seems to me to say that in order for a pretrial order to be valid, it has to be agreed upon by the parties. That's the way I read the case, and I don't think that's logical, and I don't think that's going to help parties and court get these cases to trial in a fast and expedient manner. Parties have to agree upon a pretrial order before they will be valid, so to speak.
Counsel, if you go give your co-counsel a little time.
You have about 2 minutes left. Yeah. That.
I don't, finally, let me just say I don't think case law, procedural law, or logic seem to dictate that a new pretrial order is necessary every time the case is mistried. Every time a case is passed,
it sure would encourage the trial court to get it tried, though, wouldn't it?
It probably would, but it's not going to encourage attorneys. And attorneys seem to take advantage of every opportunity they have.
You just said the trial judge had the discretion.
trial court's discretion.
That's correct.
To go to trial or not to go to trial. If he goes to trial, pre-trial order will not survive that trial, he'd be more apt to finish it.
That's correct, but...
And put it to trial.
That's correct, but obviously sometimes the trial court doesn't have...
This is not a central issue, but I'm making the observation that if we could make the trial judge be stuck with his pre-trial order, he might go ahead and try the case instead of freely granting passes that some trial courts are wont to do.
That's probably true, that the trial court is often put in situations where he's got five cases settled and not, he can't try at all.
The other problem here is do we recognize a pretrial order like the May 24th order that's retroactive in effect? That is, it says that everything's happened in the last 5 days.
Well, I guess is this pretrial order a 166 order, or was it a motion for sanctions, or an order that resulted from a motion for sanctions? I really don't think you get to that distinction right there, because the January 5th, 1987 pretrial order was still in effect.
If we followed Ross, went along with that kind of reasoning, then we've got an issue of the May 24th order.
I agree. And the May 24th order may be retroactive in certain respect, in that it refused to allow discovery to continue. Responses had not been made to that discovery that had been requested in that 5 days. So theoretically, the court could say, well, you filed the discovery, but I'm going to stay in response to that discovery. That action by the court would not be retroactive.
Any further questions? Thank you, counsel. We're now ready. I'm sorry, but you have no time.
How much?
That's 30 minutes.
Yeah.
We're now ready to hear a response argument from the petitioner.
Send him a bill anyway. Send him a bill anyway. You showed up and we're ready.
Your Honor, there is an unfortunate misunderstanding as to what the status of this case was and how the trial court was responding. This case was not a situation where the trial court was tardy or failed to move the case to trial when it needed to go to trial. I don't think it's right for the court to feel critical toward the trial court for not moving this case quicker. I assure you that sometimes these cases develop in such a way that it just would not be fair to push the case to trial faster than it has gone to trial. One, the plaintiff had never asked for a continuance in this case. I might mention that was a question the court inquired of. There was a continuance sought and obtained by Mr. Nall back in December, for the December 1986 hearing. Trial said when he wanted to go on a ski trip. But that's the only time I can think of where a matter was passed for that sort of a reason. I assure you that this court is overreacting in some regard, to some extent, on the need to push every case to trial quickly.
You're saying you never moved for a continuance.
I moved for a continuance only when we wanted to bring in our latest treating physician, Dr. Cook, as an alternative motion to the court's not allowing us to use her for the May 15th trial. If the court was not going to allow us to use her, I asked any alternative for a continuance.
Well, what happened in these first 5 or 6 settings?
There were all kinds of reasons, usually relating to deposition.
What do you mean relating to deposition?
One party, as I say, I've never asked for a continuance. I have been under the mistaken belief that I was ready for trial every time the thing came up for the trial. But I'm not arguing that the defendants were not entitled to a continuance when they asked for it, and I don't want the court to feel that was the case. They asked for continuances formally or informally, and the court granted them. I objected at the time. But I don't think that it was wrong for the court to have granted those continuances if I stand here today, and I'm not complaining of it if I stand here today. The case developed at a speed that I think is appropriate, and I think it would be a mistake for the court to say that in every case, a case such as this has to be moved quicker than this one was moved.
What's your definition? You said we're trying to push the trial rapidly or quicker. How long has the case been up there?
The case, I believe, was filed in 1984.
And when was the action?
1981. So the case was probably filed in 1983. It was filed just before the statute of limitations was to run.
So you're surely not contending that we're pushing anything to trial. This case has been progressing at a snail's pace.
Let me explain why. Because this is typical of several cases that I'm aware of. The plaintiff was not able to explain to me what his harm was. You look at him, he looks okay. He was electrocuted, fell 40 feet, landed on concrete on his head. His neurosurgeon said that he had recovered as completely as he would recover. To look at him, he looked fine. I wasn't living with him. I didn't know what kind of problems he was having. He was reporting to me very little. It was only later, when he was sent to a neurologist to determine why he was having continued headaches. This is a treating physician. None of these so-called 25 experts are experts for the purposes of testimony only. They're every one of them treating physicians. Everybody who we thought might give what would be considered to be expert testimony was named as an expert, or attempted to be named as an expert. Five people who work for TPNL who might express opinions as to whether or not electricity could arc the distance that was allegedly involved in the electricity supposedly jumped from a wire to the boom, were named as experts, but they were witnesses, fact witnesses, who were also named as experts. There were 15 doctors or so, I don't know the exact number, who were named as experts, but they were all treating physicians. It wasn't until 1985 that this young man saw another doctor to determine why he was having these headaches and these other problems. At that time, this doctor ran tests. The test showed, the EEG showed that he had slowing in his brain, and that the doctor said that he had a seizure disorder. He referred him to another person, a neuropsychologist. This neuropsychologist gave us a report. We had to go back in and seek to have these people designated as experts. Then they had to have their
definition. When did all of this occur? You're just saying these things happened, but we don't know when they happened.
The record before you contains when each of these things occurred. It happened only after 1985, December 1985.
I'm interested in things that happened after May 1988.
All right, after May 1988, the man was committed to an institution. There were doctors who saw him not associated with the plaintiff, who determined that he needed to be committed to an institution. There were doctors at the...
that's a fact witness. Just come down and say he was committed to an institution. That's not expressing opinion.
But why
say he was committed to an institution because of his mental incompetence.
But I want to ask that doctor why he was committed. What did he find? What is his opinion as to that patient's condition? What will happen with him in the future? Also, after, and apparently you're not keying in on the psychiatrist that he started seeing in February 1988, who we believe we need to call as an expert to express opinion in this case, as well as future medical.
Has there been a motion granted striking the designation of that psychiatrist?
Yes. Not only as a fact, as an expert, but also as a fact witness. Not only as an expert, but as a fact witness. And then...
Why don't you have a remedy by appeal on that?
I have a remedy by appeal. Let's say I get a judgment for X number of dollars. We don't want to go to the trial again to find out whether we were entitled to X plus 10 or X plus Y. We're entitled to try our case, full case. We need to try our full case. Why should we have to go through two trials in a useless trial, find out that you're entitled to that expert's testimony. That expert is his treating physician, the only physician he has seen since February of 1988. The defendant has said that there were two experts that he wanted to depose that were named in 1986. One of them was a doctor that moved to North Carolina, who he said wasn't important, but he wanted to depose it, who referred plaintiff to Dr. Cook. Dr. Cook is the treating physician. Now, please understand that within 2 weeks of the May 16th trial, the defendant sought and obtained permission to take the deposition of a neuroradiologist that we had never heard of before, and apparently they had never heard of before. 2 weeks before trial was not too little notice for us to have to come in 2 days after notice to take this doctor's deposition. Surely, what's sauce for the news is sauce for the gander, where they can call somebody on 2 days notice, 2 weeks before trial, or less than 2 weeks before trial, if that's not unreasonable, why is it unreasonable for us to be able to call someone who's been treating the guy for the last 8 months, the only person who's been treating the guy for the last 8 months? Also, as regards this Touche distinction, as counsel tells you, they've got experts. Between May 19th mistrial and May 24th new pretrial order, we asked for them to tell us who their experts are. Now, we cannot bring up on appeal a bill of exception showing what their anything regarding their experts, because we don't know and we can't prepare for trial based upon a deposition of their experts. I mean, we have a right to know before we go into trial who their experts are.
Well, why didn't you do that before you were set for trial May the 19th then?
Your Honor, I'm telling you that sometimes we make mistakes. I had filed interrogatories such as that with the other defendant. I didn't realize that I had not done it with this defendant. Sometimes it happens, but what is justice?
Are we to say that the judge abused his discretion because you made a mistake?
Yes. Why does that not make sense? Discretion has to do with what makes sense. What will impede the carrying out the processes of the law and justice? To require them to tell us, just to tell us who their experts are, so that then they can't go out and get new ones.
They're required to tell you who your experts are, who their experts are, if you ask them by interrogatory.
Well, I want to be able to ask them between...
Good Lord, how many years have you had to ask them?
Your Honor, this case is not now set for trial. It is not now set for trial. I didn't ask that this case not be tried on September 6, 1988. The court's response on its own motion put this trial off. We wanted to go to trial, did not seek a stay in this court, so that we wouldn't go to trial on the date set, September 6, 1988. We are now sitting in a situation where we may never go to trial. I mean, it may be 10 months down the road. Between now and then, can I ask who are your experts so that we can at least pin them down, so that they will not be in the unfair position of being able to change and do whatever they want between now and then? I have to sit in a static situation where I can't bring in any people who have been treating the guy for the past year. That's an unfair deal. It just doesn't make sense. Now, counsel has indicated that there was a standing pretrial order from January 5th, 1987. There is nothing in the record, and there is no order to that effect, that the pretrial order of January 5, 1987 continued past August 10, 1987. There is no record that sustains that allegation. Now, this court may or may not be aware of it, but just last week I received a standing pretrial order from the Honorable Jesse Allen out of Dallas, setting discovery deadlines for December for a February trial setting, and stating in that order that such pretrial order will continue if the case is not moved, will continue indefinitely. Freezing discovery. Now, I would argue with you, A, that our case is different from that, in that we did not have such an order as the Honorable Jesse Oliver imposed, or he thinks it was fairly imposing. The such pretrial order is not reasonable. I think that whatever orders are entered must be reasonable in terms of when the case is set for trial. What can be done between now and when it is to be tried? To freeze a case in any status quo is not going to promote justice, is not going to promote fair, full determination of the facts. If you want to carry out the principles that you enunciated in Touche, and I know maybe that will be questionable with some, but if you want a fair and full determination of the facts, you're going to have to allow us to proceed to discover and to do whatever needs to be done while the case is in fact pending. Now, once the case is set for trial, orders may be entered which are reasonable. At least, if orders can be entered, then they should be entered in terms of what can be reasonably carried out and fairly carried out within the time that is available. Now, as can be seen by this case, and by your own experience as trial lawyers, we can do a lot within a short period of time if we want to. When I first started practicing law, we were taking our depositions in every case on the eve of trial. We did not take any depositions until the eve of trial. I don't know why that was the case. But we would do everything by agreement, everything was friendly, nobody ever fought about anything. We just said, okay, let's take the depositions Friday and go to trial on Monday. I don't know how we did it in those days, but we did it. In this particular case, the defendants were allowed to re-depose the plaintiff within a month of trial, re-depose, not depose, but re-depose, and depose an expert within 2 weeks of trial. I'm not complaining of that. I do that, and I think that we ought to be doing that. I'm telling you as a practical matter that we cannot try these cases if we are straitjacketed with these time limits. I am promising you that people will be coming up here crying and screaming for the rest of our lives if those are the rules under which we have to live.
Thank you, counsel. That concludes the argument in the first case. The court will now take a brief recess.
The audience will please rise.